Still morning. Good morning. If you're wondering why Doug Hurley is here today, it's just in case. Yeah. Yeah, he's got my back. Actually, Doug is proving one of my adages that's been I've used for about 30 years so now. 30 years now. Started 30. Remember the old baseball movie Field of Dreams? If you build it, it will come. Close. No. The better one is if you feed them.
Yes.
They will come. Yeah. Especially true of college students, I found. But no. Doug has his reason, very good reason, and it's not me for being here. So and there's others too. Wow. 10 days till Christmas. 10 days till Christmas. It's hard to believe. I love this time of year. I don't know why we started celebrating, we being Christianity. I've read a little bit back and forth. You know, where did they start the tradition of celebrating the birth of Jesus in December? Because as we all know, there's nothing in the biblical text to suggest that. There's nothing to suggest any time of year, as far as I can tell. But I like it because of when it comes in the way the sun is, the days are just starting to get longer again. What is it, the 20th, 21st of December is the shortest day of the year. And I think it's appropriate that, it's kind of like every year there's this time of where it seems like, oh, it's getting darker and darker and darker, and then it starts to lighten up a bit. And it's like even more than the spring, which I'm going to talk about in a second, it's like here we are being reminded of new life that's coming. And that's true in the case of with Jesus. I mean, if you think about it, he didn't start his ministry at birth. I mean, there was a little bit there with some angels and shepherds and wise men. But it's kind of, it's like this is the promise of a reason to hope in the birth of this child. And that's what we get every year. We get the reminder of that with Christmas every year. Now, I also wonder, based on some walks I've been taking. We have a little dog, and I take our dog out for a walk just about, I guess, every day. And I can't help but notice then that because of the rains that we've had the last few weeks, things are starting to green up a little bit, right? That everything had died off since, June, July, and we're just kind of going along, and now we're getting new growth again. And that always excites me to see the little green things popping up and to see how quickly they're going to get big enough to come to flower. You see, I was born in Nashville, Tennessee, where we held off spring until April, usually. So it's kind of fun to see it here in December. And again, I think it goes well with this time of year, with Christmas. Just last week at our church at Conejo, we had a candlelight service in the evening, and I was doing part of the solo reading, if you will. And one passage that I had heard about, I've read in the past, but for some reason I had never read it with Christmas time, and yet here it is, and it's about this. It's there's three or four passages kind of along the same lines that I want to lay out here for us, the first half of the sermon. But this one, start with this one, Isaiah 35. I won't read the entire chapter. It's not that long. It's only about 10 verses. But it begins this way. The desert and the parched land will be glad. The wilderness will rejoice and blossom. Like the crocus, I had to look that one up, crocus. It's like a wild buttercup, or, you know, kind of the first flower of the spring to come up. Like the crocus, it will burst into bloom. It will rejoice greatly and shout for joy. And it goes on. And then the next verse. So strengthen the feeble hands. Steady the knees that give way. I'm beginning to understand what they mean by that. Say to those with fearful hearts, be strong. Do not fear. Your God will come. He will come with vengeance, with divine retribution. He will come to save you. Then will the eyes of the blind be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then will the lame leap like a deer, and the mute tongue will shout for joy. Water will gush forth in the wilderness. Streams will flow in the desert. The burning sand will become a pool. The thirsty ground will be bubbling springs. In the haunts where the jackals used to lie down, grass and reeds and papyrus will grow. And there will be a highway there. It will be called the Way of Holiness. It will be for those who walk in that way, in God's way. And a couple of verses later, only the redeemed will walk there. Those that the Lord has ransomed will return there. And they will sing, they will enter Zion with singing. See, it's the feel of spring here. It's the feel of new life. Of after a time of feeling like, you know, is this the end? Is this how it's all just going to slowly fade away? And then God rejuvenates. God renews. God restores. God breathes new life into a place that, at least for a while, looked like there would be no life, no more life. Or I think of this psalm then, Psalm 146. Here's another one. Someone reintroduced to me not too long ago. Psalm 146, beginning in verse 5. Talking about God as creator. Blessed are those whose help is the God of Jacob, whose hope is in the Lord their God. Verse 6. He is the maker of heaven and earth, the sea and everything in it. He remains faithful forever. And then notice. He upholds the cause of the oppressed. He gives food to the hungry. The Lord sets prisoners free. The Lord gives sight to the blind. The Lord lifts up those who are bowed down. The Lord loves the righteous. The Lord watches over the foreigners, sustains the fatherless and the widow, frustrating the ways of the wicked. The Lord reigns forever. Now, it's interesting to me how they move from one thing to the next. If you notice in both of these, they're talking about God working in creation, renewing life, and then how there's this reversal of things that goes beyond just the dry becoming full of the green, you know, the all the brown kind of used up life, if you will. Now we have the fresh spring and the fresh grass growing up. But it's also this reversal of people's situation. I mean, look at this again. If you're in Psalm 146 with me, verse 7. He upholds the cause of the oppressed. In other words, he causes to stand up those that are being pushed down, those that are being pressed down by who knows what sorts of situations. But God is the one who lifts them up. Those that are hungry, God gives food to them. He gives food to the hungry. God sets free the prisoners. See, that's what happens when life comes in. All of the negative, all of the, you know, the pushing down is lifted up. He gives sight to those who were blind. He lifts up the ones who are bowed down. When I read that one, I always think of my grandmother in her latter years, in her 90s, who was stooped over almost 90 degrees by her arthritis to lift up those bowed down. He watches over the foreigner. He sustains the fatherless and the widow. You see, those are people who are without sort of social, financial support. And God is the one who steps in to treat the foreigner like a citizen, to treat the fatherless, to be the father to the fatherless, and the husband to the widow. That's what God does. And they connect that to God as creator, to God as the one bringing life in a place where it seemed like there was only death. How fascinating. And so with that, then, I go to one of our, if you will, Christmas passages. Luke chapter 1. This one also was read last week at our service. Luke chapter 1, beginning in verse 46. You all know this one. It's called the Magnificat. It's the words of Mary as she's gone to visit Elizabeth. You know, the Sarah-like woman, the Rachel-like woman, the Hannah-like woman, who had been wanting for years and years and years to be able to have a child, and who had been unable to do so. But now, because of something they don't understand, we call it a miracle, she is now in her old age pregnant, and Mary has gone to see her. And Mary herself, as we know, is bearing a child in unusual circumstances, right? And when they meet each other, Elizabeth goes, "Whoa, what was that?" She says, "The child within me leaped when you greeted me, Mary." And Mary is realizing, putting two and two and two together here, something amazing is going on, that God is not just giving life through her, through a mother in the form of a child, but God is doing something bigger, grander than that. This is just sort of the tip of the iceberg. And so she breaks into song with this Magnificat, with glory. And she says, starting in verse 46, "My soul glorifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior. For God has been mindful of the humble state of His servant. From now on, all generations will call me blessed. For the Mighty One has done great things for me." The Mighty One has done great things for me. "Holy is His name. His mercy extends to those who fear Him from generation to generation. He has performed mighty deeds with His arm. He has scattered those who are proud in their inmost thoughts. He has brought down rulers from their thrones and has lifted up the humble." Do you hear that reversal language again? "He has filled the hungry with good things. He has sent the rich away empty. He has helped His servant Israel, remembering to be merciful to Abraham and his descendants forever, even as He said to our fathers." Now, I find that last little turn there very interesting, because it's all about Mary, about me, the individual, but then she sees it as God doing something for His entire people, not just for Mary. How interesting that sometimes what one person does, what God does through one person, He's actually doing for the entire people. Oh, there's just so many thoughts there. Abraham. I'll put this one out. Go back and look at the promises. Think about the promises that God made to Abraham, establishing that eternal covenant with Abraham and his descendants. I'm thinking about this, folks, because I've just been reading, grading about 200 or so final exams. And one of the simple questions I give to my freshman students is, so what are the four promises that God makes to Abraham? I wonder if you guys, you know where to find them in the story of Abraham. But if you think about it, what do we have? Land, descendants, blessings. I will bless those who bless you and curse, and through you all nations will be blessed. And then also, a little as you get farther and farther into the story, it's I will be your God and you will be my people. Or in the case of Jacob, over and over again, I will be with you. In other words, a personal relationship. But now think about each one of those. The land. Here is Abraham, who is what? A sojourner, a vagabond, who has left his homeland and he's without a land. And God is saying, I'm going to give you a land. You see, he's going to reverse his situation. Here's Abraham, or we should say Abram and Sarai, who have been trying for years, wishing for years to have a child. And what is the promise? You will have as many descendants as there are stars in the sky, as there is sand by the seashore, as there is the dust of the earth. That's a reversal of situations, right? Here you are. You are someone who has left your home, left all of your, what, stability, all of your financial holdings, and struck out because God told you to. And now what is he promising you? Blessings. He will bless you. Again, reversal. And then finally, I will be with you. I will be your God. You will be my people. Abraham is someone who has abandoned, if you will. He's left his people behind. And God is saying, we're going to have a special relationship here. And so it's all this about taking where you're where God takes you where you're at, where you don't have so many things, and he comes in as the creator, as the one who gives life, and he brings life into that situation. And that's what Mary taps into here. She says, look at the great things you have done for me. But it's not just for me. It's for all of your people. That you're keeping those promises. And again, it's things like feeding the hungry. Again, it's things like taking care of the sick, bringing healing to them. I think also of Jesus' statement to the disciples of John the Baptist. Remember that they come to Jesus and they say, now, are you the one John's been talking about? He's been talking about the Messiah finally coming. Are you that one? And Jesus doesn't just say, yeah, that's me. He doesn't just, you know, give a business card and say, yep, there it is, Messiah. You know. Instead, he says, well, you go back and you tell him what you have heard and what you have seen. And what is that? That the blind receive their sight. That the lame walk. Those who have leprosy are now cleansed. Those that were deaf hear. Even those that were dead have been raised. And the poor are hearing good news. Go back and tell him that. And he'll know. Yeah. It's happening. The work of God is going on. Now, in reflecting on this, I had to stop at this point and think, well, you know, so does that mean we should be expecting to do some miraculous things? You know, there's some people, I think, that expect that. It's like you can't prove that God is working through you unless you can find someone with some illness and then miraculously it's gone. You know, someone who couldn't walk now is able to walk because what? You put your hands on them or said a special prayer over them. And I think that is not my experience. I've never been present to see that being done. I've never done it myself. And yet I feel like, I know that I have seen God working in many, many ways in my life, in the lives of my extended family, my friends. It's the working of God. It's just not something miraculous. And so now I go to one other passage, and then we're just going to talk for a couple of minutes. The other passage I think of is in Job. I probably, in the years that I've been here, I've mentioned this one before, but I'll mention it again. In the book of Job, there's an interesting section. Well, a lot of it's interesting, of course. But one part in particular, in chapters, 26, 28, 29, in that section of Job, before Job finally shuts up, kind of the last thing that he does, I see the book of Job sort of laid out, I'd like to describe it as a trial in reverse. Okay? Usually what happens is you come in and, you know, the accuser tells you, here's what's wrong, and then you have the debate, you know, the attorneys on either side presenting the evidence. In this case, it's like you have the attorneys coming in and presenting their evidence, and then at the end, you finally meet your accuser. All right? And the attorneys here are Job defending himself on one side and his three friends saying, no, here's what you must have done wrong to justify what he's going through. But the last thing, after his friends have stopped saying anything, Job speaks for three or four chapters, and essentially what he does is gives sort of his final statement to the jury, if you will, to the judge, who's finally going to show up. Anyway, in this, he's defending his character. And particularly in chapter 29, he talks about his role in society. That he is what we would, you know, see as a village elder, someone who frequents the gate of the city, where the business of the city takes place. And he's someone who, he talks about how much he's been respected through the years, that when he would speak, you know, it's like the old E.F. Hutton commercials, when he speaks, people listen, right? Because they recognized him as someone with experience and wisdom. Well, a part of this that stands out for me, when you get down into, about verse 11, 12 and all, he says, beginning in verse 11, whoever heard me spoke well of me, those who saw me commended me, because why? Because I rescued the poor who cried for help, and the fatherless who had none to assist him. You see, the man who was dying blessed me. I made the widow's heart sing. I put on righteousness as my clothing. Justice was my robe and my turban. And then notice this. I was eyes to the blind. I was feet to the lame. I was a father to the needy. I took up the case of the stranger. You see that? He didn't say, I healed them of their blindness. He didn't say, I cured them of their lameness. He says, I was eyes for the blind. I was feet for the lame. So, you know, if someone, like the guy who was healed at the pool in the days of Jesus, you know, he couldn't get down into the pool right at the time when there was healing power in the water. He didn't have anyone to be his feet to carry him there. Right? See, so it's not just, like I said, I got kind of stumped with this when I'm reading these passages and they talk about, you know, you've brought sight to the blind and hearing to the deaf. But sometimes the work of God is done not in healing, but in those of us who have those abilities step in and perform certain responsibilities, certain actions on the part of those who can't do it for themselves. And in doing that, I think what the Bible is teaching us, in doing that, we are participating in the work of God's ongoing creation. We are perpetuating, we are contributing to the giving of life, which is what we were commissioned to do all the way back in Genesis chapter 1. You see, we are in the image of God, looking over all that's been created, and a part of that is to give life. And so how do we give life? By doing all sorts of what Job just called justice and righteousness. These are the things that he wears. You see? It makes me think of the end of 1 Timothy, when Paul writes to Timothy and says, tell those rich people to do what? To be rich in good deeds, to clothe themselves in good deeds. Oh, my goodness. For some of us, that's some powerful stuff to listen to. You know, we're so concerned about how we look, right? If we would be so concerned about how our actions look, more than what are we going to put on to go out? Wow. What could we be doing? What should we be doing? So anyway, as I'm thinking now through this, thinking, first of all, we're at a time of the year when we're remembering the renewing of life, which is symbolized in many ways, one of those being the birth of Jesus. Here, notice this, in the birth of this child, we all think of the birth of a child as, of course, new life, a renewal, new hope. We have hopes for what a child can grow up and enjoy and be. Right? So now, here I am wondering, how do I feel, how do I show renewal in my own life? Doug, please don't share this. About 5 weeks ago, I turned 60. Was that a baby? Is that what you did? No, please, no. But I start thinking, you know, I probably should have been thinking this way years ago, but it's like it's hitting me. Oh, time is limited. You know, relatively speaking. Does that mean my time is over, though? No, not at all. Not at all. It might mean that I don't have some of the same strengths that I used to have. But I think there are other strengths that I now have that I didn't have. Right? So there are things that I can be doing. There are still dreams. There are still hopes. There are still aspirations that I have that I can still do. There are other dreams and aspirations which are no longer possible. And that's fine. But you see, the steadfast love of the Lord, new every day. It's renewed day after day, season after season of our lives. So what I see, I'm really going to expand out here. What I see is, I use this definition with my students. When I start talking about justice and righteousness, I read those terms. Those are sort of just summary terms. What is that? What does it mean to do justice and righteousness? That's what God calls us to do, is justice and righteousness. What does that involve? I'd be thinking about that for a second, because I want to put one other element in here. In all of this, talking about God restoring life, renewing life, talking about God giving promises to Abraham, a big part of that is blessings. And so we talk about life as a blessing. There's so many blessings of life. The food that we eat, the air that we breathe, the clothes that we wear, the shelter that we have. All of these are blessings. And so the birth of this child is a blessing. Mary sings for joy because of this blessing. Here's the difference, I think, between believers and non-believers, at least one of the differences. I think non-believers, you see, God says that He blesses the just and the unjust. He gives rain to both. The difference is what you do with that. What do you do? If you're a non-believer, what do you do with your blessings? You enjoy them. You see them as something to be used for your own pleasure. And I think, sadly, even a lot of believers look at it that way. But what I see in Scripture is that the giving of blessings by God, what He is doing in that is He is enabling His people to do what? To help others. It's enabling you to do justice and righteousness. It's a way of enabling you to provide eyes to those who cannot see, to be the feet for those who cannot walk. See, it's a way of promoting further life. God says to Abraham, not only will I bless you, but through you all nations on earth will be blessed. You see, I am enabling you to bless others. And how do you bless others? By doing God's commands. By helping those in need. By the shorthand definition that I give of justice and righteousness to my students is that you have those who are at an advantage and those at a disadvantage. To do justice and righteousness is to alleviate the disadvantage of those who are disadvantaged. To do injustice is to use your advantage to take advantage of those at a disadvantage. Wow. Think through that. What do we do with, if your advantage is experience, do you use your experience to harm, to take advantage of someone who's inexperienced? Or do you use your experience to help someone gain experience and wisdom? If your advantage is wealth, do you use your wealth to take advantage of someone's poverty? Or do you use your wealth in order to help someone who is poor to become not disadvantaged? I think believers have a different attitude about what we do with blessings. Blessings are not just for us to be able to enjoy, but for us to alleviate the suffering, the disadvantage of others. So in what ways can we do this? Oh, there's so many. There's so many. At this time of year, one of my favorite stories, I guess favorite songs, is the Little Drummer Boy. You know, think about that one. As now I'm passing 60, heading toward 61 and 90 or whatever else is out there, I think, yeah, I can't do maybe some of the things that I used to be able to do, but there's still lots of things that I can do. I'm beginning to think more and more of retirement. There are things I want to do in retirement that I just don't have the time to do right now, but I will have the time to do. Right? Just little things. The little drummer boy. What can he do? Nothing except play a drum. And that's more than enough. We have so many things like that. I think back, way back, 40 years ago when I was a youth minister in a small town in West Texas. there was an elderly woman there who passed away. And the following week, we got four phone calls. I say we, the minister, I was the youth minister. The minister said in the following week, he got four phone calls about her, about Edna May. And each one was, what are we going to do now? Each one was an elderly woman calling and saying, what is your church going to do now? Because Edna May was bringing me groceries once a week. So who do you have assigned to do that now? And each time the minister had to say, we had no idea she was doing that. But that's what she was doing. Other elderly women, she was making sure she was their feet for them to go to the grocery store and buy their groceries and bring it to their house. There's things like that that can be done. I could go on and on. Frankly, what I'd like to do is hear other examples. I'll give you one other, very, very similar. She's not here. She'd be embarrassed if I mentioned it. But Kathy Cooper, you guys all know, you've heard this before. It just warms my heart when I've heard about where Kathy would talk about how there'd be someone, you know, just right on the edge of losing their housing. They have to choose between paying their rent and buying groceries for the family. And she would show up at their door with a bag of groceries. Same sort of thing. You know? You can do that kind of thing. And maybe you can't. Maybe all you can do is give a word of encouragement. Maybe all you can do is give 20 minutes of your time. But every bit of that, whatever you can do, is a continuation, another ripple in what Jesus does, what God does through Jesus, beginning with his birth, with the life that he gives. Ah, it's an amazing thing. Well, I will stop there. Our number is what, 544? Yeah. And I looked up the title, forget. Anyway, so I'm really encouraged. I want to hear your stories. I want to hear at this time of year. I think maybe this brings it out in us more than other times of year. What sorts of things do you do? Or maybe you're not comfortable sort of bragging on yourself, things you have done, but things that people have done for you. Things that people have done for you that you've really appreciated. Just a little thing, a card, a kind word, any number of things. What have those things been? Let's remember now, in all of this, those are little bits of life. Life that we enjoy, and as believers, we recognize that they come from God and that they are there to enable us to be spreading that life, that light of God to others. Let's be thinking about that while we stand and sing.
Without you, my God.